How did you find the book?
Teach yourself.
Not much teach
yourself. The person is leaving the title. It's good in classes. It's much more difficult.
Actually, he died before the book was published.
Really?
Yeah, he committed suicide.
Hopefully, he wasn't the first of
them. Well, it's one of the category of suicide. It's 2 o'clock, I don't think anybody else will come. Well, welcome everyone to the last seminar in this series, Theories of the Text. I think it's the last one. And today we're looking at... Last week we looked at the idea of social action considered as a text, and that article by Paul Ricoeur. And this week we were looking at reader response theories, theories of reception. The text in the reader. And I don't know if anyone got a chance to read Stanley Fisher's article. I'm assuming that you haven't necessarily read it. That's okay. We'll go through it now, really. More people. We just started, really. So we're looking at theories of reception this week and the text in the reader. So I thought, as usual, I'll just go through the summary of Stanley Fisher's argument, really. So a text is read or received by someone. For some group. Yeah, a text is read or received by someone or some group. And here we'll examine in more detail the third aspect of the semiotic triangle that we spoke of 2 weeks ago, which is the for those for whom the text signifies. Do you remember the semiotic triangle? You've got a sign, that which it signifies, and that and the for whom it is an interpretant, and the for whom it is significant in some sense. So in that semiotic triangle, we're looking at the third dimension of it today. And there are three important figures here. Wolfgang Isser, Jauss, and Stanley Fish. Isser is famous for reader response criticism, as a sort of phenomenologist. In the 70s, really, he was writing, where he spoke of the text as the experience of the reader. He emphasised the reader in the experience of the text. And the text is given to consciousness, and criticism is a description of the reader's path through a text. So, a reader response criticism then is the analysis of the ways in which the reader forms meaning through reference to other texts, completing the meaning and so on. So, as opposed to Hirsch that we looked at in the first week, where you've got the text is a sort of pristine entity whose meanings are preserved and remain constant through time. For Jauss, the meaning of the text doesn't lie in the text itself, but in the reader, the reader who responds to the text in some way. Developing those ideas, Jauss talks about an aesthetics of reception and a text being an answer to a horizon of expectations. We all bring a horizon of expectations to the text, which is then reinforced in other ways. And that the focus shouldn't be on the individual reader, as in Isser, but rather on the history of the reception of the text through time, so the way the text is received. But still, the emphasis on the reception rather than the instigation, rather than authorial intention. So we've moved completely away from authorial intention to the reception of the text by a community or an individual. And finally, Stanley Fish develops this idea of the interpretative community, the text, the group for whom the text is meaningful. And the text by Fish and these other thinkers is only meaningful because of the community of reception. Now, Fish is an entertaining article. Is there a text in this class? Short article. Opens with, I don't know if you've read it, but it opens with the a student comes up to him at the beginning of the class and says, is there a text in this class, in his English literature class? And he doesn't quite know what to say, because on the one hand, yes, there is, on the other hand, there isn't. So his article is about that. But what she meant was, of course, is there a prescribed text for this class? Is there... Oh no, she didn't mean that, sorry. One meaning would be, as he goes into it, is there a prescribed text for this class, like the Norton Anthology of English Literature, he quotes. Or is it, as she says, do we believe in poems and things, or is it just us? That's the question that she poses to Stanley Fish. Is the text... is what's important in the text only our interpretations of it, or is the text something independent of us? So he starts off from this question, is there a text in this class, asked by the undergraduate. And he goes into the postmodern problem, in which no text can mean anything in particular, and where we can never say just what anyone means by anything he writes, quoting Mayer Abrahams. So that is, the literal or normative readings of a text are overridden by willful interpreters. So there's the problem of if there are no fixed meanings, can a text mean anything you want, or what's the constraints, what are the limits around textual meaning? And he then goes on to discuss the idea of a normative or literal reading of a text. What is a normative or literal reading? So, example, is there a text in this class? That very question asked by that student. And he says that the text here has two literal meanings. One is that it's about a textbook, so the girl is asking about a textbook for the class. And the other, that it's about the instructor's position on the status of the text. So he goes on to say that she asked that question partly because she knew the kinds of classes that Stanley Fish would run. So there was a horizon of expectation on her part about that there wouldn't be a text in this class. Now, both understandings are not imposed on the text, but are a function of public and constituting norms of language and understanding. And these norms inhere within, quote, an institutional structure within which one hears utterances as already organised with reference to certain assumed purposes and goals. So those two meanings, is there a text in this class, is a textbook, or the instructor's position with regard to the text, are... Okay, if we call these two readings then, is there a text in this class 1, and is there a text in this class 2, then 1, is there a text in this class, i.e. is there a textbook in this class, is interpretable only by someone who knows what's included under the general rubric first day of class. So anyone who understood this is the first day of class and someone says, is there a text in this class, they understand that what the answer could be to that question. So then one is but is there a text in this class 2, i.e. what's the instructor's position with regard to the status of the text, is interpretable only by someone who knows the meaning of the first, is there a text in this class 1. But there is a sense in which one reading is more normal than the other. So more people would hear, is there a text in this class 1 than 2. So someone able to hear two would be able to hear one, but someone able to hear one would not be able necessarily be able to hear two. So if there are texts in this class, could be understood by anyone, virtually, who understood the notion of the first day of term. But anyone who understood the first day of term wouldn't necessarily understand the is there a text in this class too, which is a question regarding the author's understanding of the nature of textuality. Yeah. He said that it could also be, is there a text in this class 3? He doesn't say what that is, though. But there is a sense in which one reading is more normal than the other. More people would hear one than two. Someone able to hear two would be able to hear one, but not the other way around. It's kind of an important point in this reading. So the category of the normal is therefore not a transcendental category, but is an institutional category. So what's normal? Normative readings are determined by institutions, are institutional, are socially founded, grounded. And this accounts, because interpretations and understandings are socially and institutionally grounded, he says, this accounts for the success of Hirsch, Ed Hirsch, who we looked at in the first week, and others, could appeal to a shared understanding of ordinary language. So that was from week two, those readings from week two. So Hirsch's kind of common sense theory of the text is accounted for. The popularity of it is accounted for because of the institutional nature of understanding. Okay. Do you remember Hirsch? Hirsch's that you have his phenomenology that you have. He's interested in authorial intention, and a text is what an author intends, and the text, the meaning of a text is the same through time. And that the critic's task is to understand the real meaning of the text, which is the author's intention. Now, Fish comes along and Yass and others say, well, no, that's not the case. What we have are texts, and we don't have access to authorial intention, and a text is meaningful only because it's meaningful for some community of interpretation, or for some group of people, within a particular horizon of expectation. Quote, the obviousness of the utterance's meaning is not a function of the values its words have in a linguistic system that is independent of context. Rather, it is because the words are heard as already embedded in a context that they have a meaning that Hirsch can then cite as obvious. So it's an interesting point. So if we think that a text is obvious, the meaning is obvious, it's only because we exist within a certain horizon of expectation, which is institutionally constituted and socially determined, according to Fish. So we're attracted by Hirsch's understanding more than Fish's, perhaps, because we're predisposed to that kind of understanding through the kind of community in which we live. So it is impossible to think of a sentence independently of a context. Where a context is not specified, we will automatically hear it in the context in which it was most often encountered. And Fish says, Hirsch invokes a context by not invoking it. So there's a certain assumed background in Hirsch that he doesn't that he's blind to, as it were, because it's non-reflexive. But Fish says that there's always a context there, even if it's just assumed or implicit. I won't go to philosopher's non-comprehension. Yeah, he goes on about some philosophers not understanding that is there a text in this class too, but I don't think I go into that. The change, let's go into this, the change, this further quote, the change from one structure of understanding to another, i.e. from one to two, is not a rupture, but a modification of the interests and concerns that are already in place. And because they're already in place, they constrain the direction of their own modification. So you understand a text because of certain assumptions and preconditions and presuppositions. And you can understand further meanings of the text. So you can understand, is there a text in this class too? Because of you can understand the first normative meaning of it. This actually sounds a bit obvious, actually, doesn't it? But I guess it wasn't obvious when you wrote this article. So, yeah, they constrain the direction of their own modification, these structures of understanding. And it's also to do with relevance, that relevance is a big area in linguistics, I think, these days. Abrahams and Hirsch assume that authority depends on a determinate core of meanings. Because of the absence of such a core, there's no normative or public way of construing what anyone says. So that's Hirsch's position. If you haven't got a core meaning which is the same through time, how can you be certain of meanings? Where does certainty lie? Why can't a text mean anything you want if there's no core meaning to a text, no determinate core? And that, says Fish, puts meaning into the private realm. It means that a text is what I make sense of it as. So ironically, actually, because although Hirsch says, okay, the core meaning of the text is in the text itself, which is self-consistent through time, Fish says, actually, through claiming that there's a determinate core of meanings in the text, as Hirsch does, is actually to put it into the private realm meanings are purely within the private realm. Because in literary criticism, this has the implication that I'll take that back. You've got the opposite of what I just said, in fact. The same as what I said, only the opposite. So you've got Hirsch's view that the determinate meanings, which are consistent through time, the opposite of that, you could argue, would be a kind of relativism that meanings are purely private and purely individual, and that therefore text can mean anything that you want it to, as it were, and that literary criticism therefore means that there's no interpretation more valid than any other. That's a problem. Is it if it's not the case, as Hirsch says, that there is a determinate meaning to the text, which is persistent through time? Is it the case then that meanings are purely within the private realm, and all interpretations are equal? That there's no one interpretation is truer than any other interpretation? Because if you haven't got a core meaning of a text, how can you judge correct or incorrect interpretations of it? That's a problem that he wants to address. But no, says Fish, that's not the case. It's not the case that one interpretation is as good as any other, even if you don't have a determinate or core meaning of a text, because communication occurs in situations that assume certain structures or assumptions, i.e. certain communities and certain kinds of values. There are practices of understanding and goals already in place. So language is always perceived from the very first within a structure of norms. So it's not that one interpretation is as good as any other, or that all meanings are in the private realm. You've got a community of expectation and certain norms validated within the community, and values brought to the text before the text arrives, as it were. They're already in place. So there are practices of understanding already in place. So it's not a choice between either determinate core of meaning on the one hand, which is unchanging, or all meanings are equally valid on the other, all interpretations are equally valid. Sort of individualistic private realm idea. You've got meanings of texts are collectively arrived at, are constructed through certain shared assumptions, certain shared values of a community of text receivers within certain structures or norms. Now, a counter-argument is that this leads to relativism. But, says Fish, everyone is situated somewhere, and so the idea of an asituational norm makes no sense for such a person, i.e. for anyone, because every human being is situated in a particular context. So the notion of a non-situational norm of meaning in a text doesn't make sense to Fish. So prior availability delimits in advance the paths of a consciousness. So the paths that our consciousness can go down in the interpretation or readings of a text are constrained by the community of reception in which we inhabit. So therefore, one, communication does occur in spite of no context-free systems of meaning. All systems of meaning are context-dependent. There are no context-free systems of meaning. And communication does occur, even though, as perhaps Hirsch would argue, you have no context-free system of meanings. Hirsch would say that you do have context-free systems of meaning, and that's the meaning of the text. Fish says that, no, that's impossible. And even though there's no context-free system of meaning, communication does occur. Secondly, then, those who participate in communication do so confidently, i.e. they're not relativists. People who participate in systems of meaning and communicate confidently, and so they're not relative, they don't adhere to the view that you're locked into a private world of meaning. So, in other words, he's arguing against the... If you have a determinate meaning view, the opposite of a determinate meaning view does not necessarily entail relativism, or a counter position does not necessarily entail relativism. So three, confidence is the result of a set of beliefs which are not individual specific but communal and conventional. So that's his point, really. The communities, texts are received by communities of reception, and meanings are communally and collectively arrived at within the values and the expectations, within the horizon of expectations of a given community. So what's important is not the meaning of the text, but its reception at a particular time by a particular community. It's the community that determines the meaning of the text, not the text itself.
What would you say about mathematical texts?
That's a good point. Yeah.
And in some ways, those also depend on the context.
Right.
Like certain axioms and certain assumptions.
Yeah, you probably want to put mathematical texts along with all other kinds of texts. Say that the meaning was dependent on community perception. I don't know. What do you think about that? It's a good question.
I think it's quite similar to Wittgenstein's idea of language also. And he says about mathematics that even if you have a series like 1, 2, 3, 4, you could not objectively say how to continue this line, but it would also depend on the community of the game. So I guess it would substitute also.
Right. So 1, 2, 3, 4, you couldn't carry on saying 4, 5, 6, 7 unless
you can, but it's not like they are naturally, but it also, I think, if I understand it, like it also depends on the game.
Yes. Well, I think Fish would have gone along with that. You've got a certain kind of game that's being played by the community, language game. Yeah.
Well, in terms of normativity, so he's saying that, depending on where you're situated, there will be a certain normative reading, like based on your situational context.
Yeah.
But are there situational contexts for which a text doesn't have a valid reading? So, like, I'm thinking about sacred texts.
Mm.
Like, I study the Old Testament, and, Jews and Christians read it very differently based on their expectations.
Mm.
And is so if there's a reading, do you say that this is a valid Jewish reading, this is a valid Christian reading, or is one community more valid than another?
Yeah, I think the logic of the fish position would be the former, that this is a valid Jewish reading, this is a valid Christian reading.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think for him you could go further than that. Now, someone like Hirsch, it's very difficult. I mean, even Hirsch, he would want to say there's a core meaning to the text, but what that is, I think even Hirsch would be pressed to say independently of communities of interpretation. In a sense, the fish position is an obvious position in a way. But the problem comes, of course, when you get arguments over the real meaning of the text, as it were. So for many communities, it's not enough to say, oh, this is a Jewish reading and this is a Christian reading. Because of the further claim that the Jewish reading is the true reading or the Christian reading is the true reading. And that's where conflicts arise, conflict of interpretations. So it leads into my questions here that I was going to get us to look at before we look at these extensions. How is this relevant to the disciplines outside of literary studies, if at all? But it seems to be, in a sense, from the question that's just been raised. What's the status of philology, which entails establishing a stable text, critical emendation, the idea of a determinate meaning, or does it? And what's the status of revelation for a community if meaning is contextual? So we could look at some of those. Well, the middle one, what is the status of philology? So certainly in classics and in Indology, you've got to establish the text. There's a need to establish the text through critical editions and so on. Now, does the notion of a critical edition entail a kind of Hirschian notion of a fixed meaning in the text, which is consistent through time? It relates to that distinction between work and text. Is it that you have a work which is somehow not expressed perfectly in the world, and you've got witnesses to that work, which is the text? So when you do a critical edition, you've got witnesses, you have manuscripts which are called witnesses to the text, which implies this distinction between always the Platonic work and text distinction, or witness distinction. Does the practice of philology entail that distinction between work and text? And if so, does that not support the Hirschian position and is against a kind of Fishian position that the meaning of a text is only in its reception by a community? Or can you have both? Can you, first of all, establish the text philologically, and then, secondarily, understand its reception, its modes of reception? That's a very interesting question. Somebody once said to me that philology was the eradication of subjectivity, which I thought was an interesting idea. Philology is the eradication of subjectivity. Because the system of grammar, the objective system of grammar, eradicates, on his view, subjectivist meanings and interpretations. So you're establishing the text on text-critical criteria determined by the system of grammar. So when you do a critical emendation of a text, and you correct the grammar. And what's the justification for that? It's a big debate, really, in literary studies and so on.
This is structuralist, I suppose, the universality of the grammar.
Yeah, because that assumes, in a sense, that philology sort of assumes that universality of the grammar. And because of the universality of the grammar, you can practice critical emendation, so you can correct manuscripts of texts. And the notion of a critical edition is getting back to some pristine. So you could have a critical edition, as you do in Sanskrit, where the text actually doesn't reflect any one concrete manuscript, but is almost like an ideal construction, where all the grammar is corrected and so on, and all the variants noted. Or you get another kind of, I can't remember what they call it, there's a name for it, a bit democratic edition, is it? Where you take one edition as it occurs at one particular time and use that as the basis, and then you note variants from that. So it's like you take a snapshot in time of this text, that this is the text in 1260 or whatever, in this place, and you do a critical edition based on that. Without doing a stemma. So that's an interesting question. On the one hand, one would like to believe Fish, and though you can see the sense of what he's saying, that meanings are conventional and communities of reception determine the meaning of text, and yet on the other hand you can see the rigour of the philological enterprise in establishing the text historically. So what do you think? Is there a true meaning of a text? Or do we just have multiple interpretations depending on the context?
I suppose it depends on both, because he has to use the grammatical norms to express anything.
Yes.
But interpretation is already assumes the grammatical norms in people's mind.
Yeah.
So it goes together, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes a text will reject grammatical norms. I mean, like James Joyce is one example. Like,
yeah.
You can't just use standard grammatical norms to understand what the heck is going on in Finnegan's Wake.
Sure.
So,
but even if he rejects, he already rejects the already existing norms, which is already in his mind.
Mm-hmm. But what if, let's say, for example, someone comes from a community and they don't speak English very well. Is their reading of Ulysses less valid than a native English speaker?
Mm. Yeah.
Or, I'm not Irish, I'm from America. Is my reading less valid than someone who's Irish who can pick up, there are all these languages in there, there's Gaelic, there's Latin, and if you don't speak those other languages, can you have a valid reading of the text?
Mm. Mm. Or can you have a more valid reading, as it were, if you're from... If you're from Ireland and you've studied that period of history or whatever and you understand all the references, is your reading more valid than someone who hasn't? That's a very interesting question. How about this? Yes, how about that? Fish would say no one reading is more valid than the other. And indeed Ricoeur would probably say, like, all texts are equal to me. But someone like Hirsch would say, yes, there is authorial intention. Joyce's authorial intention has to take primacy over other interpretations which might be Hirsch, extravagant or eccentric. But
for the first question, I guess scientific data can be used as an example. Interpretation of the data,
right?
Which in certain conditions,
well, that's
can
right.
Be interpreted
good,
differently.
Yeah.
Same approach.
Yeah, I used to have a friend in Lancaster who used to go to CERN, that physics, throw particles down that accelerator, and it was all. He always said it's all interpretation. You get piles of mathematical things coming out of the computer, and they sit reading them and interpreting them. Think, oh, this relates to that. So they see patterns. They're watching for patterns. Now, whether the patterns are in the in the experiment or in their minds, who knows? I don't know. Perhaps it's a bit crude, but there's an element of interpretation even in scientific data.
The expectations are different in scientific interpretation. The expectation is that there is one valid interpretation, and that if you just have enough data, you can get at that valid interpretation.
Yeah.
Text, we might be saying there is no one valid interpretation.
Yeah.
And your interpretive, I mean, the hermeneutics of how you get to your interpretation might vary depending on what your expectations are,
mm-hmm.
especially according to Gish.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's quite a useful Jewish distinction, actually, between Jewish hermeneutics, between the plain sense of a text and the interpreted sense, derash and peshat,
mm-hmm.
which is the, I always think it kind of related to philology in a sense, so you can establish the plain sense of a text, and you don't disrupt the plain sense of a text, so you don't put knots in or whatever, you need to establish the plain sense of the text before you can have interpreted senses. And yet you could also argue, as some do, that actually even the plain sense is itself an interpreted sense, that all senses are interpreted. So that itself, the interpreted sense, plain sense, is itself an interpretative device for reading the text.
Even if we accept that all interpretations are to some part socially determined, it doesn't mean that all of them have to have the same value, does it?
No, that's right. That's right.
Putting some criteria for what makes some socially determined interpretation more valid.
Yeah. I think Fischer thinks that too. But it's not that a text means whatever you want it to mean. But the criteria of meaning are socially determined, and that actually you can't get at some pristine meaning outside of interpretation, really, and that interpretation is always community related. So it's not individual, it's not privatized, it's always communal, shared. It's a difficult one, this. I mean, you can see both the Hirschian and the Fischian position in a way. And you can see the value. I mean, certainly Oxford here is based, a lot of it, the classics and Indology is based on a science of establishing text through philology, the philological enterprise of establishing the text, the true meaning of the text. But I mean, someone could come along and say, well, actually, even those practices are themselves embedded within certain kinds of social contexts. They only make sense within those social and communal contexts of practice. So, what do you think of critical emendation then? Is that a good thing? Can you do that? If you've got a load of manuscripts, and none of them, and they've all spelt horse wrong, relatively, and they all got verbs and nouns inverted in the wrong places or something, what do you correct that? Or
as long as you're transparent about what you've been doing,
yeah.
If you annotate it, then
right. Right. And then you correct it on the assumption that there is a pure text, do you try just to create a readable text,
to make it clear to the reader, but also as the editor, to give some help to the reader,
yes.
from your perspective, but to be honest about what is your perspective. So
yes,
it's probably not wrong for the editor to have their own take on the text.
That's right.
As long as they're open about what they're doing and
sure.
reference clearly.
And it doesn't mean that you're buying into a theory of work-text distinction then, necessarily. Even if you critically amend the text and you're reflexive about it, it doesn't mean that you actually think that there's a Platonic text of which the manuscripts are instances or witnesses.
I guess that critical editions assume that there was an original text in the beginning which
yeah.
has lost. Like
yeah.
a Q text in Bible studies,
yeah.
which they try to recapture that.
Yes.
But text itself is considered as a real, not as an abstract.
Sure, as a real text. Yeah.
Which usually manuscripts are lost throughout
yeah.
history, so has to be reproduced again and again.
Indeed. Yeah. It's an interesting question. To what extent is it just the manuscript, or is it that there's a, is it the oral text even if the oral text you can reconstruct from the manuscripts, is to what extent would that original text, manuscript, sorry, reflect the notion of a, say if you write a novel today and you've got spelling mistakes and so on, the novel that you write on the paper is a concrete expression or a witness to the abstract work in some sense. So there's implicit in your novel writing reference to this other thing, this cool thing called the work, which is somehow perfect, perhaps. Now, is it that there is such a thing called the work, or is it always a notional and deferred thing which is necessary in order to produce a concrete historical manuscript?
Can you say that authorial intention is socially, in a social institutional context,
yeah,
and that therefore you could get that reading back, but that's just one reading,
yeah,
depending on a particular context, and then there are other readings that are normative for other contexts.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's just made me think of it, you know, if we're saying, well, the author meant to be following the normative rules of grammar, so we're placing the author,
yeah,
in another.
Yeah, we're assuming that the author is operative under those conditions that we're putting on to her or him. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Say that again. So you've got the authorial, the intention, the author's intention view, if you like, and the multiple interpretations view, or all interpretations are valid view. If you've got those two poles of meaning, were you saying that the authorial intention view is itself can only be understood within a context? You have to
that's how people try and recover the authorial intention. They always read, you know, well, what's going on during the time of the author, and
sure,
what did the author think about this, and what were the expectations of the author society?
That's a slightly different thing to the Fishian thing. I mean, I suppose Fish, I don't know what Fish would do with that. He must be aware of all that kind of work that goes on. The recurring position, indeed the Fishian position, with actually the text, it's impossible to get back to that historical authorial intention, as it were, in that way. And what matters is what the text says to us now, of some particular community and interpretation. But I suspect for a historian that's very much not what they want to do. They indeed do want to get back to a foreign intention. They claim that you can do so by looking at these questions. You know, what were the questions relevant to the author at the time? What were the conditions under which they produced their text, and so on?
Okay, it's possible to, if there are more than one text of the same author, that compare his views in the text.
Sure.
Which would be give certain sense of what he means.
I don't share the scepticism of some of these authors towards the notion of historical reconstruction. You know, that you can get back to a foreign intention to some extent. Okay, let's on this other sheet of paper, the last 10 minutes, we got. I thought we'd look at develop some of these ideas, perhaps the notion of semiotics, and look at the notion of semiotic triangle in scriptural traditions, that a text is sacred for some community, for some purpose, and that entails a certain pragmatic notion of truth of the text. The text, it goes against literalist understandings of the text, because the text is only true, the truth of the text is only for some community, for some purpose, in some particular time. So you get a pragmatic notion of truth entailed by the semiotic triangle. So you could argue that semiotics goes against certain literalist understandings of text. Semiotics is not about consciousness or intentionality. and they're therefore different from phenomenology that we're looking at in Route 2. And you could argue that phenomenology is dyadic, whereas semiotics is triadic. Phenomenology is concerned with subjectivity and objectivity, with noesis and noema, with cogito and cogitatum, whereas semiotics is always triadic. It's always about the meaning of something for someone. The sign always points to something for someone, or some context, history, etc. So you could argue that semiotics is more appropriate to the understanding of text than phenomenology, because it brings in the temporal dimension, it brings in the dimension of history in a way that phenomenology doesn't. So Isser's idea, his phenomenology of reading, is a bit ahistorical. So it's all individuals constructing meaning of the text from their own horizon of expectations. But you could say that was inadequate because it doesn't bring in the historical dimension and the community dimension. There is an extension of some of the Fichtean kind of ways of going about things in that something called textual reasoning and scriptural reasoning, which is sort of academic enterprise. So textual reasoning, it started by a group of Jewish philosophers really in the States about 10 years ago, I suppose now, where you have a single textual source, a primary source, and you a single tradition which is reflecting on its own sources. So people within the same community of reading are reading their own text that they own together, as it were, and talking about it. And that presupposes that the readers share the truth of the text. And so TR enacts interpretation as performance. So there's no theory, it's just the performance of the readings of the text. Now there's another thing that develops out from that called scriptural reasoning, SR, which has multiple sources and entails different traditions reading each other's texts together. So an SR forms a community for the time of its occurrence and then it disappears again. So there's no sustained community through time because it's just the people who are reading their texts together at that one particular time and it's dissolved. And it begins with reading and then develops theory. So it goes from scripture to theory, always goes from scripture to theory. And you get second order reflection on patterns of SR. And it entails what in SR they call a post-liberal epistemology, which is that a text has meaning for a community along Fichtean lines. And that entails a certain kind of view of truth and a certain view of the world and a certain view of knowledge, which goes away from an Enlightenment universalism. There's no universal truth of the text that you can get at, but you can have meanings of the text can arise for a particular communities in any particular time through intersubjective reading and through theorizing those readings in certain kinds of ways. So there's always a second order reflection in SR. If textual reasoning is purely the readings of the text by a community, which is generally not theorized, scriptural reasoning, which is reading across traditions, assuming a Fichtean model, entails a second order reflection, entails theorizing the practices of reading across traditions. And it also entails what they call a post-liberal epistemology, which is that you want to avoid an extreme kind of relativism because you can read across traditions, but on the other hand, you go against any notions of universalism because on this view, universalistic readings of text leads to a kind of totalitarianism, really. So it's kind of a politics of representation entailed in all of this as well. So it doesn't want to. It's strongly influenced by postmodern relativism, but nevertheless wants to maintain the sacrality of tradition, the sacrality of texts, and tries to place that in the context of these kinds of practices of reading that Stanley Fish and others have spoken about. So reflection in this sense of the scriptural reasoning is repetition of the claim in the context of a series of repetitions where something is announced to the reader. So therefore SR goes back to a beginning in the beginning as a theme, as a topos. And scriptural reasoning is the enactment of a non-identical repetition. So if you've got these two models, on the one hand you've got Enlightenment Universalism with the true meaning of the text that you can get at through getting back to authorial intention, the true meaning of the Bible, the true meaning of sacred text, which is a kind of, can be a literalistic or fundamentalist reading, which claims universality. On the one hand you have that. The scriptural reasoning people try to go against that by claiming that actually what's important is non-identical repetition through time. The repeated readings of the text or texts in a group context, so that the meanings are always made fresh and are always brought alive to a present community. So the voice from the past becomes awakened in a present orality, if you like, through the reading and repeated readings of the text in the here and now.
That makes sense, because I think sometimes, like, if all sentient beings died tomorrow, then these books wouldn't really have any meaning. You couldn't really argue that they did.
Yeah.
Because they don't have any meaning. But if then evolution occurred again, and then, you know, 500 million years, and we're all crawled out of slime, and then if these books remain, then we could actually, they would have meaning again. But that meaning, you say it's in the books, that meaning is somehow, it's just a transmission, it's a communication.
Sure.
I like to think about this about the text, and so Hirsch is standing there telling us, you know, that actually what I'm saying has some truth in it, and Fish is saying, well, what I'm saying really doesn't have any, you don't have to think there's any truth claim in this app or whatsoever.
Well, that's the problem with it, isn't it? Yeah, he's saying that, he is saying that, so, and yet, a kind of an extreme relativism, I mean, that's the problem with the extreme. All claims about the world are relative, except this claim.
As usual.
Yeah. So Enlightenment Universalism, and then you've got this non-identical repetition, which is a tradition-based understanding of text, really. Now Peter Oakes, who's the kind of the guru of the scriptural reasoning, says. He thinks it's the Spirit of God speaking through the interpreters.
Sorry, for TR, is that performance of interpretation normative? Like, does it become normative because this group has come up with it?
Yeah, it becomes normative, yes.
Okay.
It becomes normative within the TR group, yeah. Although they argue with each other, but it's within the horizon, certain horizon of expectation and certain shared assumptions.
But so in the end, do they come up with one reading that's supposed to be normative for
an
extended community?
No, sorry, I see what you mean. No, they don't. No, they come up with conflictual meanings on the whole. But they're happy to live with the tension with the conflictual meanings. There's non-resolution. And there's also implicit in some of this the idea of the finality of non-resolution. So there's no synthesis, there's no resolution. And you live with the finality of non-resolution. So these, yeah, for Oakes then the Spirit of God works through both TR and SR and scriptural reasoning. And the study of scripture works because these are God's patterns for him. He talks about the enactment of the in-between, which is invisible. Now, I'm not sure the in-between the words, the in-between the text, the in-between the people. And so SR continues a process of repetition. So Bible is a pattern of relations between sentences. What is revealed is a mode of revelation. So the revelation isn't only in the text, but in the community of reception. That's where the revelation takes place. And it's a performance of a pattern that was that's been disclosed by God, according to Oakes. So it's not an enlightenment, it's against an enlightenment universalism on the one hand, and yet it's not a relativistic position on the other, because there's this allows a reading across traditions, between traditions. So it's a process of repetition, but it's non-identical repetition, because historical circumstances are always changing. So they were. There's a kind of extension of a kind of Fichtean model in SR and TR. We don't have any strong defenders of Enlightenment universalism here, then, do we? No. Not in a religious sense. No. Yeah. Not in an atheist sense. Well, thanks everyone. I don't know if you've got anything out of that. It was slightly harder, I thought, this week than some of our previous sessions. But, carry on reading, carry on thinking, and thanks for coming to these sessions. So we might have some more in the future. Would more be useful? Would you come to more? Different, no, might be. Okay. Okay. Do have a go at Fish's article, because it's really funny. You'll have you doubled up laughing. Thank you for coming. Yeah. It's getting dark, isn't it? That's
I can't switch it off. Doesn't switch off.
I think it's just short lifetime. You have to press this one more.
Stop recording, huh?
No, it's still recording.
The recording.
There's not much debate about the methodology, but the content.
Perhaps if we ask Gavin, he may know.
Bye-bye. Yeah,
would you like to do
it?
It's
very good to see you again.
Yeah,
come back.
It is the same thing as this.